and continue through 3 p.m. August 2nd, 2016. Drawing is Tuesday, August 2nd at 4 p.m. Good luck. This is KPFT Houston.
You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. Coming up next, Technology Bites.
On Wednesday, August 17th...
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
Computer.
Believe it or not, you are listening to Technology Bites.
Everything is so funky.
Jaylee's gone.
And this episode is a special deep archive edition from 1984. At least based on the musical intro.
28.8K. Thank you very much.
Uno, dos, tres, cuatro. Yeah, you are listening to Technology Bites. I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Plicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Lee.
And he's
Groovehouse.
Wow, we're building up our strength week after week.
We
until...
almost had Dwight tonight, Pete. We came this close to this being a Dwight show. Unfortunately, Dwight
but his
bailed.
Cats had a photo emergency.
No, he said he had
family
to,
emergency.
He said he had to
family.
Buy his daughter a car or something. So he's out. He's out braving the auto dealer landscape and haggling, and you know whatever one does when one buys cars.
Does this car drive itself?
We had an angry orange supporter screaming at us like, "Make Tech Bites Dwight again."
I want my Tech Bites Dwight.
How many cats does this car fit?
2,000.
All right. Well, I guess we'll give the important informations that you need. Our website is at geekradio.com. It has links to all the articles and stuff we talk about tonight. It has podcasts of past episodes all the way back to 1984. No, we don't go that far back. You can get on the IRC through that website. You can do all kinds of stuff. It has all the different it has more activities on that website than a feminine hygiene commercial suggests. So you can get on the IRC at we're on channel Pound Tech Bytes on irc.cuckoo.com. I said irc.cuckoo.com.
You killed
wow, without Jay, somehow
he's depressed.
Lost his mojo. and again, if you don't know how to use an IRC client, only
join the club.
Cuckoo on you. IRC's only
wind the cuckoo
for,
again, like
for 23 years. But if you have never learned how to use one,
you're probably under 30.
Yeah,
and can't figure it out. You can go to our website and use our brutally unsafe Java app that you'll have to probably click about 10 dialog boxes to trust.
Does that stand for Internet Relay Cuckoo?
Or you can use the Snapchat to IRC client.
There you go.
That sounds safe. What could possibly go wrong?
I'm just going to post in Usenet. You guys look for me there.
We have alt dot Barrett. Alt dot Barrett. I was going to say alt dot technology dot bytes, but
alt dot binaries dot Barrett. It's
alt dot technology dot byte dot byte dot byte.
We've already turned on the lights in the studio.
We have. It's the red light
we
district
are,
now.
Yes. Actually, it is. We've got a single red light in the studio. It's just
for alt dot Barrett. Appropriate lighting.
I accept Dogecoin, Bitcoin, all forms of digital currency.
Hang on, let me load up my copy of UU decode so I'm ready to download these hot binaries.
When roar.
Yeah, the geek humor has evolved over the years. Jay has the story that he worked at a now purchased and subsumed into many other companies ISP called Neosoft, and so they had a full Usenet feed for a long time, and once as a joke they put alt.binaries.laserdisc, which the reason that a ISP could offer a full in the early 90s could offer a full Usenet feed is because it was all just text. And so, think about it. What was the biggest hard drive you could get in, 1994, 95, 96?
40 megs.
we were measuring in megabytes.
But
then.
It
yeah,
did.
We hadn't even gotten to gigs.
It did had to all fit on the system because mm-hmm. the entire Usenet feed was, it was generally like in one partition, like just one big thing. And
frankly, if you had turned a laser disc into a binary, it would have essentially killed Usenet. And so they set up alt.binaries.laserdisc, and immediately after they set it up and posted it, they started getting contacts from various ISPs around the country like, really, are you gonna do that to us?
A lot of places didn't carry the alt feeds anyway.
Yeah,
not anywhere worth subscribing to.
No, there are a lot of pay. That's when all the pay Usenet things started to show up. The ones where we guarantee it. Not much, but a buck or two a month.
My first ISP was Netcom. I had a NetCruiser account with Netcom, so I had one of those funky .ix.netcom.com accounts. Yeah, baby.
Cruising the internet.
And they had a great Usenet.
Roll
feed.
Down the ports.
Yeah. The first person who I knew who actually jumped ship from using the ISP news, because I went from there to like Texas.net, which is no longer around. They had a great Newsnet feed too, but my buddy Matt was the first guy I know who started paying like the $20 a month to Giga News or whatever it was because they had the groups that he really wanted to see.
The special, ones that you couldn't in polite company explain why those were the groups that you wanted to subscribe for, but
the groups
you could say it was complete and it was to get the complete feed.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, right? I mean, pretty much everywhere would carry a big list of feeds, but it was all about retention. Like, you might go and try to download something and it's got like, one part of 10,000 and where's the other 9,000 parts?
Or it's missing like two or three parts.
Yeah, right. That's even worse.
Or they just expire out. Anything that's older than so many days is
just
gone forever.
Yeah, for those who you know, weren't around during that time, it sort of like getting an image off the internet, because there was no World Wide Web, there were no web pages. This was before that existed. It was sort of like serial radio shows. And
next,
you know,
up
and,
on
and
Flash Gordon.
One image might be 20 episodes. So you'd have to get 20 files, and then use UU decode, usually.
Decode. Right,
usually
because,
UU
yes, that's
and
the
they
other
were split
thing,
into like 20, 15, 20, 25 parts, usually.
More or less, yeah, Usenet was, it was designed really for text. It's kind of like a bulletin board system where you can reply
yeah,
and stuff
there's
like
no,
that.
There's no really, it was designed for text.
Yeah, so what you would do is you would take these binary files and you'd have to somehow decode the binary, put it in something that was an ASCII that could be put up there, and then, you know, roll it back the
and
same
the
way.
And the standard was UU encode,
yeah.
UU decode.
And then also, a lot of the servers had a hard limit on how large these messages could be. 10,000
lines.
So if you had, like, you know, 10 meg file, that's going to take, you know, a whole lot of stuff, to, you know, a whole lot of messages to get that in.
I remember one of the big things that annoyed people was, you know, most people had SIG files, and your SIG files weren't supposed to be over four lines. If they were over four lines, you got griefed.
Waste.
And there were actually, like, people who would collect SIG files that were over four lines, and they would send out a post of, like, offensive signature files.
SIG offenders.
And, yeah, I got on a few of those.
Did you guys ever...
I had one line of data, 9,999 lines of signature.
No, I had a... I mean, there were some people that have, like, quotes from songs.
Oh,
and stuff. They would be, like, 50, 75 lines or more long. You know, mine were... I usually just wanted more than four lines. So mine were usually six lines.
No.
Maybe eight lines.
No.
And so I at one point I actually compiled my own TRN so that I could change the SIG size, because it was limited to four. So I changed it to eight so that I could make mine six or eight.
You're the devil. Speaking of devils, did you guys ever post in the Scary Devil Monastery on Usenet? alt.sysadmin.recovery? Which, if you rearrange the letters, spells Scary Devil Monastery. It was like the crazy Usenet group for unhinged BOFH sysadmins to hang out in. You had to do to post in it. You had to do what they called waving the dead chicken. You had to actually modify your newsreader to send a specific X header with each post. Otherwise, your post would be automatically dropped by the group. It was an insane group. Basically, every message was like this, you know, deep coded, just bunch of like inside jokes and rage. But it was a fun place. It was where I learned a lot about the art of being a system administrator.
Yeah, I wasn't a sysadmin back then.
I wasn't either. I was like 12, but it was still awesome to go in there and read.
Yeah, I never. There were a few groups, but most of my stuff was in rec music, for the most part.
I hung out a lot in Rec Arts SF TV Babylon 5 moderated because JMS Joe Michael Straczynski would occasionally post in the group. He was the showrunner and creator of Babylon 5, so he would occasionally show up in the group and post. So that was like the place to be if you liked Babylon 5 when it was actually still airing in the late 90s, was to be hanging out on Usenet with JMS and everybody. Fun times, man. We should just do a retro show. Let's just do this the whole show.
I used to, my thing, one of the big things I used Usenet for was Fetishy. No, I'm sorry. No, what I used for
what?
Was what I used it for was HTML. Early on, you know, there were web pages around, but it was really hard to find out how you know, how to do stuff. So it was like comp sci languages www.html or something. And I remember one of the ones that I'll just never forget it, because it was, I believe it was sort of the beginning of things changing radically on the web. This was back when the number of pages on the web was numbered in the hundreds of thousands, and you would go on there and like try to find websites in other countries. You could kind of go around the world. You know, find an Australian newspaper site or a Czechoslovakian, you know, site, some kind of site there, and so on, just to go find places as far away as possible. But anyways, the table tag, you know, pretty humble, but if you look at really old web pages, they really were not very different than reading a text file. About all you could do was break, you know, have line breaks. And maybe you could put two line breaks between paragraphs. And then there was some light formatting. I guess you could do bold and italic, but you couldn't do any kind of layout, let alone do, you know, if you were going to do a table, you had to, you literally had to go in and, you know, build it out of like an ASCII, like ASCII art to make it, you know, to display tabular data.
Oh yeah. Everything was tables within tables.
And I think it was, if I remember right, it was something like it was a site, it was a page at, this would have been before Netscape. It would have been Mosaic. I think Mosaic had a page that had a table on it, and somebody found it and viewed source and explained it to, you know, put the source out on the CompSci languages thing. And suddenly you could like lay out a page because you could put stuff in columns and you could, or you could have a table of data and stuff like that. And it was just, it hit like a bomb. It was one of those things where, you know, the once people saw it, then they ran off and, you know, started building new websites, and the number of web pages exploded after that.
And the coda to that story is we're still using tables today because trying to lay out tabular
not for
data,
layout.
Yes. Oh yeah, man. You're trying to do tabular layout with CSS? You might as well just slit your wrist now.
Oh, not do a table, but yeah, you can use a table to do tabular data, but you shouldn't use it for page layout.
I don't know, man. There's still, you can come up with all of your fancy bootstrap schemes and all of your multi-column CSS layouts and your responsive design and everything. But I mean, seriously, if you've got like four elements and you need to line them up, sometimes you kind of still need to bust out that table tag to fix it.
2K page load versus like, yeah, 1.4 megs in libraries. I kind of go simpler on that.
I guess there's that.
I still remember the first time I saw web pages like, had a friend who, I think, I never really used Gopher much or Archie or anything, but he did, and I remember he was like all excited. He's like, dude, you got to come. He was I think industrial engineering, and he was a grad student, so he ran a lab. I remember like, dude, you got to come to the lab and see this. Mm-hmm. Okay, so he had some. I think
Step Box or
they were SGIs. I think they might have been Sun workstations, but I think they were either SGIs or Sun workstations, and he like was like, dude, look at this. These are like grad students that have web pages for the labs they run, and you can go on here and like look at your assignments. But then there people are also putting like, you know, information about themselves, and look, you can put pictures in here and all this stuff. And I'm like, eh, whatever. That's not interesting. That stuff that'll never catch on.
Oh yeah, when I was at A&M a bit earlier, so it was the internet existed, but the web didn't. And only, you know, like engineering and computer science students had access, and you had to go to the like engineering building to get to something that would connect. And a buddy of mine was, his thing was he was very into hypertext. Now, I didn't know what the hell that was at the time. And, you know, nowadays it's kind of one of these where everybody intuitively knows what hypertext is and how it works. But
it's like those hypercolor shirts.
So he was studying that, and it was kind of like he tried to explain it to me a bunch of times because I was interested, but it was like right over my head.
You know what? Honestly, what made me grok hypertext the first time I saw it, and the first time the layout, excuse me, the first time the idea of a markup language was explained to me, I intuitively got it, and there's a very, very simple reason, and it's not because I'm, you know, an amazing genius or whatever. It's because I grew up playing around with WordPerfect, and WordPerfect had that little reveal codes button you could press, and the way that WordPerfect did document formatting and everything was it basically
turned it on and off.
Yeah, it basically did a markup, like it had its own WordPerfect markup language, but you could, like, if you hit the control I for italics and then typed a word in italics and hit control I again and then pressed the view codes button in WordPerfect, you could actually see in the view code window like the little ital and then your words and then like close ital. And like, I spent so much time screwing around with WordPerfect when I was, you know, growing up. And
what WordPerfect is that?
5.1, WP 5.1, 5.0 and 5.1.
The WordPerfect.
Version, the canonical version of WordPerfect.
Because, you know, because WordPerfect 6 was WYSIWYG.
Yeah, no, that was all Windows. Yeah. WordPerfect 6 was all in. This is WordPerfect 5.1 was the one I played with in DOS.
And that annoyed me. I mean, even back then, No, it annoyed me that it annoyed me that it wasn't. Not that there was anything that was, but it just annoyed me that like I would look at WordPerfect, you know, and like write something, and it's all just the same font, and you just kind of have to know, like, oh, if it's a black background with orange text on it, right, that means it's a Roman 12-point font.
Folded, underline.
Or if it's purple and flashing, that's what I said italic to. No, I mean, that's what we, you know.
That used to be my go-to analogy. When I used to get paid to teach, I would teach adult extension courses at community colleges about being on the internet, about using a web browser. Yes, you can laugh at your parents and grandparents who paid to take classes to learn how to use a web browser. You know, all these kids who grew up with, where before they were verbal, they could click links and, you know, use a web browser. But the parents and older people actually paid to take courses, and they would come in. You know, it wasn't even on just weekends; it would be weekday nights. They would come in for an hour twice a week for 3 weeks or whatever to learn about the internet. And that was my analogy for HTML was WordPerfect. You know how you put the formatting stuff around the words?
Well, that's right.
I can't find how to enable WYSIWYG inside my copy of Emacs on the command line.
You know what? Honestly, I'm sure there's a way.
VI doesn't look like it has it either.
I bet there's a way in Emacs. And if there's not, you could actually probably write a GUI front end to Emacs in Emacs.
Now I can spawn a complete VM inside Emacs that will then create AI that will then go out and write its own text editor.
You know what's, disturbing? Or maybe you mentioned it. At some point recently, you can actually do emoticons on the command line.
But like colon parenthesis?
Yeah. No, like not the old school ASCII ones.
Unicode.
Yeah,
they're in Unicode, so you can like, yeah. That the first time I saw that, I was like,
password.
Oh, I hate it! I hate it! This is a terminal window.
Well, there's screenshots floating around, and I think we may have done it at work for a little bit, of folks who are using some of the extended Unicode emojis as their like Wi-Fi SSIDs.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think use it. Oh, it's Unicode.
Yes, my Wi-Fi network is Turtle Cloud Rainbow.
No, what happens?
Eggplant, nice. Eggplant.
What happens in the lower depths of the firmware of some of those cards? We'll see if you're using the cheap card.
No, I mean that was. Like, I think that's how we came to it. Is like somebody had written an article about it on another site, and they were like, "We tried doing this, and it blew up our old Android phone."
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, we appear to be in a race to the future, and we're trying to it's neck and neck between H.G. Wells' The Time Traveler, where you get the like gentle but stupid, you know, leisure class above ground, and then the kind of trolls underground in the factories, versus Idiocracy. they kind of fight as to which one is the most apt metaphor for our future.
I just want my flying car emoji.
So let's say, so what do y'all think we will be taking classes on how to do?
Not dying.
Whatever. I'm gonna start doing whatever replaces like three times replaces Snapchat. Whatever is like Snapchat, but in like 30 years, I'm already absolutely like Snapchat. I've said this before. Is the first.
So it's gonna be some social media thing.
It's probably some social media thing. Snapchat is the first thing I've encountered. You know, I'll be 38 this year. I'm not ancient, but Snapchat is the first thing I've encountered that has made me feel genuinely baffled and old.
Because you don't know how to use it, or because no one's sending you Snapchat.
No. Because of the way that kids use Snapchat. Like sitting there, like
they just take.
They'll just like
and
riff
send
off
other.
Like 80 pictures of themselves, and it's like their face momentarily goes all Exorcist, and they'll do like 80 different facial expressions to 80 different people, just with like filters and like, and just like, and then like all of their friends will Snapchat, and they're just Snapchatting like, you know, there's not even text, and the images are disappearing, and it's just like it's the first thing that where like I saw somebody doing it, and I was like, I'm just totally baffled by why anyone would want to do that. That is like the dumbest, most horrible thing ever. It was the first like old man shakes fist at cloud where like I was really like, why would you have this, you stupid kids?
One I still haven't found a purpose for. You know, like texting. I didn't text for a long time, but eventually I'm like, okay, this has a lot of value. I mean, for like short, fast communication. Where you don't want to like bug somebody by calling them to interrupt them, it's very convenient and functional. But yeah, the whole like upping that to video
just
images,
just sending emotions at each other.
Where you're not actually communicating. Well, I guess you're communicating an emotion in some way, but you're not communicating any kind of actual information.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, it seems kind of pointless.
Well, when we're floating in our neurotanks in the 2070s, I'm definitely going to want to have someone upload the neuro cartridge on current social Snapchats for me in my tank.
I don't think there'll be anything to learn. Like, the big thing now is in China, like, live streaming is going everywhere. We've got, like, in any moment in time, there's like 300,000, or it might be millions. I don't think so, but it's somewhere up in there. Live streamers, people just doing like everything from random stuff to, you know, like going out on yachts and playing cards, and then people
through the Great Firewall or
no, all inside. Inside. Okay. So now the Chinese, though, they are going around and they're saying, like, hey, that's a little bit too risque. You're kicked off. Hey, you can't do that. You're kicked off. But they've set up some kind of digital currency to where you can buy virtual gifts to send to the people that run the channels you like. And that's converted into real money. So people are, like, monetizing this pretty big. But I think the idea here is that pretty soon...
They've kind of been doing that in internet culture with... Mm-hmm. With Bitcoin,
like,
and
tons of that,
because like Reddit and other places, you can tip people or whatever if you appreciate whatever they posted or whatever.
My guess is we'll have to take classes for when you have to neural jack with your technology, and so it'll be like, you know, it'll be that your grandchildren saying, Mom, Grandpa Flicked is talking to the computer again.
I think it's going to be complete.
Stop talking out loud.
Grandpa, you know that we're going to disable the voice interface and force you to use your neural jack because it's so disruptive to the household when you speak out loud.
Well, just can you put your pants on before you go full VR?
Or is it going to be
what
even
are those
worse?
Neural jacks?
It's going to be even worse, and we're going to have like the hybrid technology stuff that's, you know, from 20 years from now that's been implanted in our various body parts, and it's going to all be obsolete, and then, you know, so then your kids will have the new zippy, you know, the new
USB-C
X57 processor, and we're all clunking around it, you know. He can only accept 15 gigabits of data per second.
When you try to talk to him, he goes boing boing.
Nice, Grandpa, 56K ranging me.
Now, you kids, you know that you shouldn't be DDoSing Grandpa at the dinner table. You shouldn't be sending him every video you've ever made.
Stop communicating in frequencies Grandpa can't receive. Confine your communication to frequencies that Grandpa can tune into. That's not nice when you go outside of Grandpa's bandwidth.
By the time you get old, there's not going to be anything to learn. It'll just be all everywhere. I think the gap between technology
right now...
I know
karate.
Now...
I can't do anything, but I know karate.
Hey! Yeah! Thank you! It works in my mind.
Old man uses karate on cloud in his mind. Well, it'll all be virtual reality, and then... You won't know what anybody actually looks like because it'll all be VR, you know, and you won't know what any of your stuff looks like either, because you'll go to work in VR and your office will just be a virtual environment. You put on a helmet and you're walking around the office, or
you'll work from home.
Yeah.
Everyone,
you don't even know what your office looks
pods.
Like.
You don't have an office.
Well, they might still have some kind of physical presence somewhere, at least for mailing.
Mail.
Although maybe
What's
they won't
mail?
Have physical mail.
They'll have a little drone landing
somebody,
spot up top.
Somebody will still have physical mail for something.
Everywhere will be
tax
mailboxes, etc. There won't be any actual retail stores you can go to, but there'll be mailboxes, etc. everywhere.
No, it'll all become Amazon. Oh. Everything will become Amazon, and then when AWS 3.0 is completed and they've replaced the Earth's core with a gigantic data center to power all of humanity, We will never have to see other people ever again.
So, happy Bezos, citizen.
So, this is tangentially related to that. You know, I don't really care about the new Ghostbusters movie coming out. Whatever.
I don't hate it.
I don't think it came out yet, did it?
I have no idea.
I don't know. I'm not interested.
Because there hasn't been like the big ad blitz.
I don't hate it like some people do. I don't care either way, really. But the one good thing to definitely come out of the movie, whether it sucks or not, is that the Coca-Cola company brought back the Ecto Cooler. High C Ecto Cooler. And it's in such demand that you can't find it.
Because it's awesome.
And it goes out of stock all the time.
Well, my memory is
so
that it was awesome.
I just wanted to say that today I was able to buy 4 cases of it.
Wow. 14 cases?
Four cases. That was the limit. 4 cases.
The limit.
They make it in the little juice packs.
Yeah, that's,
I didn't want those.
I remember
they make them in cans.
Too now,
yeah. So I got 4 12-pack cans.
Was this online?
Yeah.
Okay. So my memory of, you know, the first
that
time around.
Awesome.
Have one email address?
When I was 12 and watching The Real Ghostbusters and, you know, drinking it the first time around was that it was amazing.
It's awesome.
It's not just like sugar brain blast.
I've not had it, the new stuff, but I've heard, I've read everybody who's had it.
I remember
has
it being
said
super awesome.
That it's just as awesome as they remembered it.
Hmm. All right.
So,
because
wow,
the Coca-Cola company has trouble keeping the flavor of Coke matching what people remember it was. Ghostbusters, by the way, the release date, it's basically not this coming weekend, but the weekend after. July 15th is the release date for the movie.
Well, okay.
Well, I've got 4 cases, so maybe I'll bring some.
So you need to space out your Ecto Cooler consumption so that you don't blow through your supply before the movie hits theaters.
Bring us some Ecto Coolers next week.
And these, evidently, these cans have some like thermal temperature controlled ectoplasm on them or something. So like when they get
cold
the ectoplasm becomes visible. Yeah.
What? Okay.
It's like special limited edition, but the thing is, it's limited edition in general. Like it's just temporarily back. So yeah, everybody's going crazy trying to buy this, and so it goes in and out of stock on, I think Walmart selling it, Amazon selling it. But I actually got it through HEB. HEB, any Coca-Cola distributor can sell it if they want to.
Right.
So HEB was selling it, so I got it through them. But it's online only, I think, at HEB.
That's. Okay. Name. I'm waiting to try it and get my diabetes on with it.
I just remember because it's like this, like it's like that
it's
not
green, sil-
not that silly putty, but but that goop stuff that was like fluorescent green.
GAC?
Lime. GAC.
GAC.
Yeah. It's like that, but you can drink it.
Well,
I guess you could drink the
much
other
less
one,
viscous.
You can drink it without visiting
more,
the hospital.
It's more drinky.
So good.
It's like this like radioactive glowing green. And it's citrusy sugar taste.
Well, all right. We're excited. Excited here.
Mr. Robot hits before Ghostbusters. That's 1 week from tonight.
Yes.
I feel 7:13. I feel ill. I may not be here next show. No, I'll be here. I'm just leaving it at 10:01.
I need to actually
I've got
go
a date
and,
with Mr. Robot.
I need to go rewatch because I don't remember anything.
I just binge-watched it and got to the end of the...
Oh, that's right. You were in like episode 6 or 7 last week.
Got to the end of the first season. So,
what'd you think?
I really liked it. I mean, I really liked the realistic portrayal. I guess the thing to me, and I guess a lot of the tough part is they got to the like really amazing, interesting part and then sort of leaped ahead a few days and then never got, you know, and the whole thing is, well, what just happened?
Season 2, I bet they'll revisit.
Is probably what season 2 is about, but
season,
it's kind of like...
Actually, I don't think, I mean, maybe they'll go back some. But from what I've seen, it looks and heard people talk about, it sounds like season 2 is more focused on the fallout.
You know what
of
they,
what
they
happened.
Could do? So this would be the show has, you know, a reputation for handling technology in a very realistic way. Here's what they should do. What they should do is after the, you know, the crash and the destruction and everything and the world markets are going crazy. E-Corp.
Spoiler!
Yeah, whatever. It's too late now.
Really?
E-Corp should try to enact their disaster recovery plan, and it should go horribly because
BCDR.
They
that's,
haven't been doing their
because
DR
that's the
drills.
Most likely.
Hold on, who's got the backup?
Tech
right.
reality.
Nobody like the DR facility is unprepared. There's no gas in the generator. Like they like the pages from the manual are missing.
It turns out the tapes weren't being written
the
correctly.
Tapes, yeah, the tapes are all like Iron Mountains or whatever the Iron Mountain company in the show is like. Oh, your backup tapes.
Steel Mountain.
Steel Mountain
doesn't know where their backups are.
One mountain instead of three, or three instead of one.
The staff emergency contact list is all out of date, and like They should. I mean, they could get at least a whole episode out of like how badly the DR plan, and then like all the techies watching it would be like, "Wow, the show isn't just realistic; it's like real life."
I'm having PTSD watching.
Techies with one fist up towards the TV, tears streaming down their cheeks.
I remember the last time we did a DR drill, and I'm still not recovered from it.
The closest analogy I can think of, and again, I like it, and I'm going to watch the next season and all of that. But the closest analogy would be, if in Independence Day they had all the like foreboding stuff and Jeff Goldblum finds the countdown hidden, they're using our own satellites for the countdown, and then he goes, time's up, and then they flash forward 3 days and they're standing and looking at the like smoking ruin of the Empire State Building.
That would have been such a better movie.
And going, wow, that was the most amazing. That was terrible.
Wasn't it amazing when you did that thing with that laptop? Yeah, that was amazing. Let's never talk about that again.
Thank you. Yes.
And just move on. And I guess the other thing I would say that I would think that things would have come a lot farther apart, even in the short amount of time they jumped forward. Even in the 3 days, I think if you couldn't use your credit cards over a weekend, that there would be a lot more chaos in the world than what they were showing.
3 days, things don't come unhinged yet. People have cash, people have food. It's kind of a novelty.
Some people have cash.
Just knock out all the payment processors. Yeah. Like in the real world, it wouldn't work that way. And then, you know, that's kind of like one of those things you just got to give the show. Like, you know, if they shot the horses, there'd be no movie. So you got to let them get away with like being able to cripple the world financial market by, you know, doing that one thing.
Oh, well, I wasn't even – I gave them that. It's that if you did that, then society's functioning would have been more affected more quickly, I think.
It would mess me up. I have – I do
think
not –
Think about 2008 and think about how quickly things were changing, where the deal was like when a major financial company was going to potentially go out of business overnight. The effects that was going to have and the way that you know what that looked like for people, you know, I think that it could have been, and the thing is they had a happier, more mellow version compared to what the reality that at least the reality I remember from when we had something
or like Y2K when everything totally shut down and we couldn't do anything, we couldn't get money out and everything just turned to pandemonium on the streets.
It was horrifying.
That was really bad.
Well, realistically, if all of a sudden there was like some sort of like, you know, apocalyptic financial sector event where you couldn't use credit cards for like 3 or 4 days and you couldn't, and like ATMs didn't work or whatever, that would actually really screw me up. I don't carry cash. I haven't carried cash for years. I don't really keep, you know, tremendous amounts of food in the house. And probably by day two, I'd be killing any of my neighbors.
That happens to me. That's like every once in a while I'll scan, you know, being on two wheels. It's like I don't want to take off the gloves and I want to go inside and, like, you know, pay for gas. So I'll just swipe a card, usually a poorly chosen ATM debit card at a sketchy gas station. So boom, you know, it's gone. So yeah, so every handful of months I'm out off the digital grid for a few days.
Yeah, well, the other thing is if all the financial records were erased, I think it would probably be similar to what I've read about what they did with the mortgage industry, which is the big companies just made stuff up. And you could fill in your own word for stuff there. Just made stuff up and foreclosed people's houses. That's why you heard about where people who had never had a loan on their house had foreclosures filed on them and stuff like that. I would have liked to have seen E-Corp like just basically like randomly generating balances for all the accounts that they knew existed.
We're just going to set everybody's balance to 50%.
Sweet.
Even it out. It'll wash out in the end.
We know all the credit card numbers. We know the range of credit card numbers we had. So just put them all in the system, randomly assign them, use a random number generator between 1 and 25,000. And that's their balance. That's what they owe us.
Boom.
Here is some spoiler for season two. There's a Texan nicknamed Lone Star.
Of course.
That's all we know.
Really?
Yeah.
I hadn't read
somewhere
that.
In season two. They just announced some casting things. Like, whoa, these things are hitting IMDb.
So I knew. I know that. I know that. One thing that Rami Malek said was that he got to know his stunt double
a lot
better.
Yeah, I saw that.
This season. And I know like. One of the big things is that I guess the government says, you know, F Society is the one that did this, and so they're looking for the F Society members to arrest them, and so the FBI is tracking them, and it looks like probably, you know, like they find them and are messing with them to get information and stuff.
It looks like, yeah,
there's,
I don't want to give too many things away, but if you want to go look at stuff, you can tell, like, the sex of the FBI agent, because they've listed the casting on that, so that's kind of a cool turn, who's going to be hunting Elliot and the others.
Agent, it's a pair of FBI agents, right? Sculter and Molly?
Sculter and Molly, yeah, which is, I was wondering what was going to happen after the whole X-Files re-spin up, where they were going to go, but this is cool. I like where this is going. They need to make it maybe like not surrealistic this season, though, if they could maybe do a little bit more Swordfish and maybe a little bit more like Hackers kind of screenshots. That would be nice.
Maybe a little bit of The Net.
Yeah, I like it. Maybe get Sandra Bullock in there for a guest appearance. Maybe have her driving a bus, like a data bus. I got this PCI bus.
And just flickering occasional frames of Brad Pitt.
Yeah, that works. I guess, no. Please, guys, don't do that. I assume everything's shot, everything's wrapped. They're just sitting on the secret. So
I don't know. I know that I blanked on his name.
The main director?
Yeah, the writer. Ismail?
Yes, Sam Esmail.
Sam Esmail. he decided to direct
all
the entire
them.
Season.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he directed all of the episodes this season. I think he... I guess last year he was showrunner, writer, but this year he's... And he directed some of the episodes, but this year he wanted to do all of them.
I wonder if he directed the Prison Break one. Like, if some of the slower... There were a couple of episodes that weren't extremely fast-paced. I wonder if those are the ones he handed
off.
Which
ones he did. But I know he had a very specific vision for, like, visually the style he wanted and stuff. And so you could tell some difference from show to show. But for the most part, I mean, it was... There was a kind of a consistent vision, even with the different directors, like, you know, stylistically, lighting, framing.
Yeah, it was subtle, but
like
you could tell there was it was different than other shows. And I mean, the Mr. Robot versus other stuff you see,
Big Bang Theory.
It wasn't obvious enough to me. It wasn't obvious enough to where you catch what it is that they're doing to make it.
They do a whole lot.
Sound is awesome.
They do a whole lot of. Off-center stuff. So a lot of times characters will be like very far off the edge of the screen, or the characters will all be at the bottom of the screen, and there's like all this empty space at the top. They do a lot of stuff where it's not the typical, like, oh, here's the character, so put him like right in the middle of the frame.
Well, two shot of them talking. Okay, now a shot of his face.
Well, they mentioned they're trying to give it kind of a lo-fi 90s feel. That was like kind of one of the directorial takes that Sam Esmail said, was he wanted it to revitalize some of those techniques that were used in the 90s, you know, some of those shots, and have it look very much, you know, dated in that manner, you know, kind of like Mr. Robot's
screwdriver
shops.
However, as far as I recall, they didn't use a lot of like the whole like handheld, like shaky motion.
No Blair Witch Project camera styles. That's good. Computer geeks herb easily. You don't need to jostle.
Or like the style that got really popular. I don't remember when, but where the camera, it's almost like it's mounted, but nobody's holding it, and it's like a little off balance, and so. You know, the frame's like moving just a little bit, like throughout scenes, like all the time, just kind of like barely moving in one direction a little bit. Like, oh, it's kind
of early first person shooter
slipping
here.
Up into the left a little bit. Oh, now it's going to the right.
And no lens flares. So J.J. Abrams, his techniques have all been safely kept out of Mr. Robot.
Woot.
I think my next smart TV, I'm going to look for the lens flare. Add on in that definitely has to be there.
I guess this is the first one he didn't direct of the Star Trek reboot. That comes out soon. That may be out that same weekend as Ghostbusters, or maybe the weekend after. Star Trek Beyond, I guess.
Yeah. I really like how Mr. Robot does their title. At the beginning of the show, it's almost like it's out of like a 70s movie or something.
You mean the
actual
comic or the font?
Not the font. The way they do it, like where they have whatever happening and then the titles over whatever image is there. It's usually like, I don't know, just the way they frame it and the way they pop it on with stuff. It looks like, to me, it looks like movies. There was like a certain style of movies from I think the 70s where they did that a lot.
Yeah, are they going to the split screen with that? I dig the look. I really like that. I hope they keep stylistically in season two. And it looks like, yeah, Pete's right. It looks like July 22nd is when Star Trek Beyond hits. So we're ramping up for some media. You don't have to go outdoors if you live in the South where we are sending our base home signal from.
Go to our air-conditioned theaters all scattered around.
Oh, speaking of that, that's another place where you can get the Ecto Cooler, evidently, is at Cinemark Theaters.
Ooh, must you see Ghostbusters to do that, or can you just go and be like...
No, I think you just go.
I would have guessed it at Alamo Drafthouse, although I think the Alamo Drafthouse is staying quiet, but they're going to spray the entire audience with slime whenever Slimer appears on the screen. He slimed us again. Oh, no, look, Slimer. That'd be perfect, but yeah, they wouldn't do that. Don't eat your popcorn. One free Ecto Cooler per person. Anyway, yeah, sadly, there's like a preview showing of the next Star Trek movie that's on a Wednesday night. So
I'm going to be sick that night, too. Oh, man.
Not going to miss a show.
My health is just not good this year. Actually, no one should. If anyone watches it, I don't know what time it comes on, but I'm assuming it comes on sometime around the show. Do not see anything in IRC, or else the we will K-ban you, we will K-line you. we will trace down your home IP address.
I think it's during the show. I think it's 8 to 9.
Okay.
I have to check.
It's not spoilery, but I think that it is interesting, sort of, essentially, that he kind of, he doesn't release their stuff to other people, but he basically kind of doxes, or he builds a, he searches out all the info that can be scraped up about a person. It's kind of fascinating. Although the funny part is, usually the guys who have the skill to gather all that data don't have the skill to like figure out what it means in people's lives and how it affects how they think. You know what I mean?
I don't understand people or what you just said there.
You know, well, there's all kinds of moments where he's like, yeah, I know all about, you know, they charged this at this store, and, you know, where he knows things about people because of the records that he's cracked about them, like their credit card purchases and their other stuff.
Or that poor sysadmin at the hospital.
The one guy,
he is their IT department, but he doesn't patch their servers. This is why I told that. Why he chose the hospital, awesome. So that he can change his records.
Yeah. Or the guy that...
Ooh, the guy at Steel Mountain.
Yeah, yeah, nobody will care.
Rips into that guy. Oh,
because he has all the cats.
Would anyone miss you if you just didn't come into work tomorrow? Yeah, it's kind of eviscerating.
So usually people can either have one skill or the other. They can either gather all that data on somebody without it being much effort, or they can understand what the data all means about somebody and how to psychologically manipulate them. Most geeks, nerds, sysadmin types don't do both. They can only do one or the other.
Like, you can have computer hacking skills, but you can't have that and bow hunting skills.
I have unicorn skills, drawing skills,
draft skills,
ninja skills. Well, yeah, you're either mitnick skills, or you're who is the good opposite of that? You know, it's either social engineering to get in, or, you know, hardcore, you know, crack it, zero day exploit type
catch them
of stuff.
A delicious bass.
Nunchuck skills.
Side ponytails.
There's got to be a canonical list of Napoleon Dynamite skills out there. I'm just having a hard time finding it right now.
No, that was it. I said two of them, and Lee said the other.
Yep.
Yeah. It was nunchuck skills, bow hunting skills, computer hacking skills.
Pedro offers you his protection. I feel like we need that today. Today
I think Pedro is the on the show we should have Santos.
We all need Pedro's protection these days.
Would Pedro make us do the news, or what would Pedro
do?
Well,
we've got 10 minutes to the top of the hour. We should probably, like...
We have less than that. We got to cut out too early, don't we?
Oh, yeah, I guess we do. We should probably just banter for another 8 or 9 minutes and then make Pete do the news post-break.
I may cut it down or do very short, much shorter versions of the stories so that we can have more discussion. You know, the podcast format... Frankly, I Don't mind it at all. I like it. It's a matter of finding us, of having subjects that we want to talk about and that fit together, which so far we've done pretty good.
Managed to waste a tremendous amount of time this evening.
You know, one of the things, I guess, you know, as we fill the rest of this time, you know, we were talking about movies. There's the ones that people are excited to come up, you know, coming up. But amazing to me is the fairly substantial movies that have come and gone without really making much of a blip. Independence Day just, I think, flopped fairly mightily. I mean, made some money, but it cost so much that it didn't. You notice it's not something everybody's talking about after the 4th of July weekend. It seems kind of odd. You know, it's not a big deal. It's not.
Well, and remember the first one, right? The first one was absolutely, and maybe maybe my perceptions are a little skewed because at the time I was all about that movie. I remember my buddies and I waited in line to go see Independence Day for like 2 hours, and it was amazing, and everything was exploding. And I remember that movie being a huge big deal. When did it come out?
12. No.
Wasn't that young, man. No, it came out in 96, right?
I don't know.
I think it came. Okay, hold on. Let's see.
I'm just thinking because I don't remember being excited about that movie at all.
Oh, no.
I remember seeing the promos and the ads for it made it look intriguing.
1996.
Okay, so I was 20 years. I was 18. And I was like, about it.
I think I must have watched at least part of it. I don't know that I ever watched it, actually.
Oh, we were there opening night.
Friends drugged me opening day. We went, and I remember the whole theater cheered when they nuked Houston.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I remember that, too.
So it was like, we showed the friends.
They showed the fake sign for, like...
Spoilers.
They showed... and that was it.
The mountains in the background.
We didn't get a cityscape. We didn't get, like, any kind of... We got, like...
We got the University
of Houston exit.
Yeah, we got the university, like the fake University of Houston exit sign.
And a couple
that
of lights, which
real.
May or may not have been the Chase Tower, maybe. Right. We don't really know.
That was awesome. There was another 90s movie. Oh, I was going to say, the other 90s movie that, like, called out a Houston city on screen very briefly was Judge Dredd, if any of you guys remember. Oh, yeah. Judge Dredd.
RoboCop 2.
In Judge Dredd, there was a brief shot, like, and not Dredd, the cool one that just came out relatively recently. This is the, you know, the Sylvester Stallone movie.
The one with the...
Right. Very, very briefly, as they're showing, you know, it takes place in a dark post-apocalyptic future, and humanity is crowded into these gigantic, you know, massive cities. And they show a map of, like, all the places on Earth, on the cursed Earth, where people still live. And there's, like, Mega City 1, which is, like, where they are in the Northeast. And then, like, down on Texas, there's, like, this big block, and it's, like, Texas City. And everybody in the theater was like, "Whoa, yeah, Texas City!"
Where's the dike on the map?
Out of all the places that would survive, like, why would we let Texas City live and not other places?
Well, especially since if you, like, walked near it with a match at the wrong time, the whole place would go up.
Well, you know, the future has much lower standards.
versus Houston itself. Well, RoboCop, they used, instead RoboCop of 2. Using actual future Detroit, they used current 80s Houston.
No. Midtown. It was RoboCop 1, they used parts of Dallas. RoboCop 2... They filmed in the George R. Brown for some of their interior scenes, but I don't think they did.
There were exteriors. Okay. It was Midtown. It was down south of downtown because you could see the tall buildings in the background. Okay. It was one of those where I watched it. And it's like, why does that look so familiar?
Actually, I've been told that the building that I currently work in was actually the office of one of the head police officers or something. I've yet to.
Oh yeah! Wait, here we go.
Andrews and Wilson, Fourth Ward. There's a whole list.
I'm looking
of
at
all
it. It says RoboCop 2 was chiefly filmed in Houston in 1989. Ideal location due to the relative calmness of downtown Houston at night. Okay, Jefferson Davis Hospital was used as the location for the nuke manufacturing plant. The finale of the film was shot in the theater district near Wortham and Alley. Cullen Center was depicted as the headquarters of OCP. That's awesome. Well, Houston City Hall was shown in a scene where the mayor speaks to the
press
and
conference.
Then George R. Brown and the Bank of America Center were also included in the film.
IMDb now has full filming locations that matches up scenes to actual, like, streets and, you know, like,
awesome.
You know,
that's
addresses,
pretty cool.
Which is nice. Because before you had to guess, there were, like, a few different sites you had to go and maybe someone would say something, but this is, like, the definitive everything.
Man,
like,
if RoboCop 2
branch,
had
police station.
If it had been a better movie, that would be Really cool.
Opening scene, Prairie in Maine, right downtown. I think that's right by the Rice. Oh, that's Texas and Maine, I suppose, but right around in there.
Wow, man. Yeah. Not really a great film either, unfortunately. I wish it had been better. Because then we could
that was one of those sequels they weren't really prepared to make. They made the one and they weren't ready. That's the tough part. You got to think when they're making a movie, especially in the Hollywood system, because the movies that are creative and break new ground and are interesting, usually the person who created it does not have an extended series of things in mind. So it's like their first album, you know, their whole life built up to this first album from the group. And then it's a massive hit and everybody goes, hey, make another one like that this year.
That was all I had.
And they're like, I had every relationship I've ever been in is in that album. And I
picked the cream
of
the crop from 15, 20 years of material.
Everything else I have inside of me is dumb.
or else I can make a whole move. Well, I can make an album about how it sucks to be on tour and about groupies. How about that? That's two songs.
A cocaine album.
Think of every rock band ever has a, like, you know, oh, the road, the long road, Bob Seger, you know, kind of steel cowboy or whatever, riding on something.
There's that Metallica song that's a cover of that older song where they talk about that.
But anyways, but so, you know, the Independence Day cratered the X-Men movie back in May. Kind of made no impact on people. They don't think about it, talk about it. You know, it's like Fight Club, except people follow the rule. And first thing is, you don't talk about.
Oh, that's right. There was another X-Men movie.
Alice in Wonderland, which I'm not lumping. You know, it's, but like big superhero movies had been doing really, really well up till now, and then X-Men kind of.
I think Deadpool did well, right?
Yeah, I like Deadpool.
I still haven't seen it, but I want to.
Yeah, me too. Well, that sound says that we have covered many subjects through the first hour.
Is that what it's
called? Frivolously, stuff, frivolously wasted an hour of your time.
Mr. Robot.
But we'll try and redeem ourselves in the second hour, so you need to tune in and listen to the
Trust
whole
us.
So we'll be back in a few minutes. You are listening to Technology Bites. I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Lee.
And he's
Groovehouse.
America chooses its next president in November, but we want you to mark your calendar for coverage of the road to the White House. Pacifica will broadcast from the Republican Convention July 18th through the 21st, the Democratic Convention July 25th through the 28th, and the Green Party Convention August 4th through the 7th. Stay tuned for times of each broadcast as well as what we're sharing over on Facebook and Twitter. Again, convention coverage kicks off July 18th. It's made possible through the generous support of people like you. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston.
KPFT transmite por el aire 24 horas del día, 7 días de la semana y cubre diferentes tipos de gente y gente con diferentes estilos de vida. KPFT está aquí cuando usted necesita lo mejor de noticias, independientes y música durante el día. Pero manteniendo este tipo de recurso no viene barato. KPFT necesita su contribución para continuar a tener esta estación única cuando usted lo necesite. Si usted está escuchando cuando se prepara por la cama o cuando se está levantando en la mañana para el trabajo, ¿por qué no hablar a la línea de departamentos de miembros a KPFT y hacer un miembro? El número es fácil. Para recordar, es 713-526-4000, extensión 314. O puede visitarnos en nuestra página kpft.org y dar su contribución. Esto es KPFT Houston.
You're listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. We now return to Technology Bites.
All right, well, maybe we should push the button and hit some news.
Push the button.
I wasn't prepared. I just had to play through all that stuff.
Your job is literally to push one button.
Hold on, there's a button.
We could replace you with a playlist.
I've got a shell script.
Somebody sing a song or something.
Sudo-su. Going over into scripts. ./.
Do we even have a show anymore?
Here we go.
It's the Technology Bites Info Shot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
This is the quick and abbreviated on some stories since we're, you know, doing the show a little different this week. You can go to geekradio.com and there's links to the full articles that are the source material for all our stuff. Here's one. Now you can, if you want to get a little deeper on the hacker thing, we're going to give you some new terms. This is from an article in Wired, which I thought was pretty cool. For years, the U.S. government's offensive hacking operations were kept in dark shadows, neither acknowledged nor discussed, which changed with the discovery of Stuxnet, of course, in 2010. A computer sabotage operation reportedly conducted by the U.S. and Israel to destroy machines used in Iran's once illicit nuclear program. Stuxnet was the first operation to be exposed, but it's not the first government hacking operation ever conducted. Documents leaked by Edward Snowden in 2013 shone a light on a vast underground operation conducted by NSA's Tailored Access Operations Team, TAO. That's a brilliant kind of Zen deal for a hacking operation. Responsible for what government refers to as computer network exploitation, so CNE, and computer network attacks, which sound like the same thing, but there are differences between them. And this way you can sound like you get this one. You can like learn about and feel all cool for Mr. Robot, where you can identify whether it's a network exploitation or a network attack. Computer network exploitation, or CNE, refers to espionage and reconnaissance operations conducted to steal data from a system or simply to obtain intelligence about networks to understand how they work and are configured. Examples of CNE include Flame, a massive spy tool used to gather intelligence from Iran and other targets, and REGIN, R-E-G-I-N, or REGIN, which was used to hack the European Commission and Belgium's partially state-owned telecom, Belgacom. A catalog of custom NSA hacking tools leaked to reporters in 2013 shows the vast capabilities available to TAO hackers. The tools, with names like Picasso, Irate Monkey, Cottonmouth, and Water Witch, which those names tell me they had real geeks working on this stuff, can subvert firewall servers and routers or impersonate GSM base stations to intercept mobile phone calls or siphon data from wireless networks. There are also bugging devices the TAO hackers plant in targeted computers to siphon data via radio waves to listening stations, sometimes located up to 8 miles away from the victim's machine. In 2011, the NSA launched 231 offensive computer operations, according to Snowden documents. This including placing covert implants in more than 80,000 computers around the world. So just a little minor side deal for the NSA. They aren't doing anything on a large scale. And then here's some neat product stuff. You know, we tend to focus on like cool products and things that work well and, you know, do a really good job. But there's always the role of, say, obsolete technology. If you heard a bunch of old people with calloused thumbs crying out in, you know, all at once and suddenly going offline, it's because BlackBerry, the BlackBerry Classic with a physical keyboard, is no more. The company recently announced it will no longer make the BlackBerry Classic. It was first launched in late 2014 as a replacement for the BlackBerry Bold. This isn't the complete end of physical keyboards for BlackBerry. They still produce the Passport, which features a smaller physical keyboard to create more space for the phone's touchscreen. There's also the Android-based BlackBerry Priv, which has a slide-out keyboard. But what is going away is the BlackBerry form factor, their physical keyboard design. Though the Priv's keyboard is its spiritual successor in some ways, the company said it's discontinuing the Classic to make way for new devices. People have been using the BlackBerry with that kind of format for a long, long time. So there are people who are very set in their ways. Just for an example, although it's not from set in their ways, but more from the Secret Service and company knew how to secure it. So President Obama had to stick with a BlackBerry because he had to stick with the BlackBerry because they couldn't secure a different phone. And then the other negative, you know, you've seen all the stories about hoverboards. You know, the reports that they were unsafe, could catch fire or explode or those kinds of things. Well, now there is a recall. The Consumer Product Safety Commission wants, if you've got a hoverboard, they warn that, quote, lithium-ion battery packs in these self-balancing scooters/hoverboards can overheat, posing a risk of the product smoking, catching fire, and or exploding. The latest recall covers products from 10 companies, including Overstock.com and Swagway, not to be confused with Segway. Segways haven't been recalled for batteries exploding, but Swagway has. So they think that it's half a million hoverboards are affected. The CPSC has investigated more than 60 hoverboard fires in more than 20 states. That resulted in more than $2 million in property damage. So maybe you need to look at if you have a hoverboard, you need to go see on the recalls. And then another, I guess, technology fail. Apparently, Android's full disk encryption just got much weaker. This is from Dan Gooden at Ars Technica. He says, privacy advocates take note, Android's full disk encryption just got dramatically easier to defeat on devices that use Qualcomm chips. There's new research that reveals several methods to extract the crypto keys off of a locked handset. Those methods include publicly available attack code that works against an estimated 37% of enterprise users. So about one third of Android phones are exploitable this way. So you may want to... you may want to watch out. Both Google and Qualcomm are quick to note that both of the vulnerabilities involved have since been patched. The first was patched in January, while the second was patched in May. Google also pointed out that it paid the researcher for his work through the company's bug bounty program. But researchers at Duo Security told Ars that an estimated 37% of all the Android phones that use the Duo app remain susceptible to the attack, because they have yet to receive the patches. The lack of updates is because of restrictions imposed by manufacturers or carriers that prevent end users from getting their updates from Google. So isn't that nice? So if you're Mr. Super Privacy and you say hate Apple, so you got an Android phone, you may want to check and make sure that you're not, that you don't have a vulnerable phone. And then here's one that when we get into it a little bit, I'll give the story, and then I would very much love to hear the input of the panel. This one is sort of fascinating. It affects hacker laws and such, but I don't think in a wise way. Senior U.S. District Judge Henry Coke Morgan Jr., a federal judge for the Eastern District of Virginia, has ruled that the user of any computer which connects to the internet should not have an expectation of privacy because computer security is so bad at stopping hackers. The ruling was made on June 23rd. It was reached in one of the many cases resulting from the FBI's infiltration of a site called Playpen, which was a hidden child exploitation site on the Tor network. Basically, after the FBI took control of the site, they kept it up and running, using it to plant malware on visitors' computers and gathering identifying information that was used to enable prosecutions. The judge ruled that the FBI's actions in hacking visitors' computers did not violate Fourth Amendment protections and did not require a warrant, stating that, quote, the defendant here should have been aware that by going online to access Playpen in this case, he diminished his expectation of privacy. The judge offered as an analogy a previous case, Minnesota versus Carter, which ruled that a police officer looking through broken window blinds does not violate anyone's Fourth Amendment rights, so hacking a computer does not either. That's the analogy he's using, is that computer security is so broken that hacking a computer is like looking through broken window blinds. He notes that in 2007, the Ninth Circuit found that connecting to a network did not eliminate the reasonable expectation of privacy in one's computer, but takes the position that in the last 9 years, things have changed enough to render that position outdated. The judge, this is a quote from the judge's ruling, "Now it seems unreasonable to think that a computer connected to the web is immune from invasion. Indeed, the opposite holds true. In today's digital world, it appears to be a virtual certainty that computers accessing the internet can and eventually will be hacked." As justification for his opinion, he cites the Ashley Madison hack and a Pew Research Center study on privacy and information sharing as evidence of the acceptance that hacking is inevitable. So the thing to me on this if it's so inevitable, then I have to wonder, why is hacking a crime then? If it's basically so pervasive and all of that, how can they make laws? How can then it be illegal is one question. Let's see. Judge Coke Morgan's level of technical understanding appears to be highly selective. The same judge who ruled on a patent case between VIR2US Inc. and Invincia Inc. over competing claims covering advanced anti-malware products fails to acknowledge that anti-malware products continue to advance. He says that, quote, terrorists no longer can rely on Apple to protect their electronically stored private data, as it has been publicly reported that the government can find alternative ways to unlock Apple users' iPhones. He ignores the level of expertise needed to identify the exploit that was used to access the phone used by one of the San Bernardino attackers, or that the hack in question only was applicable to the iPhone 5C, which is not the most current phone. Describing the ruling as, quote, dangerously flawed, EFF senior attorney, staff attorney Mark Rummeld wrote, quote, the implications of the decision, if upheld, are staggering. Law enforcement would be free to remotely search and seize information from your computer without a warrant, without probable cause, or without any suspicion at all, but holds out that the ruling is incorrect as a matter of law, and we expect there's little chance it will hold up on appeal. Yeah. So, I guess my question to the panel is, can you believe... as I read it, the judge's analogies and all of that stuff, knowing what I know about computers, yes, no computer is unhackable, but taking that and flipping it around to that every computer is just so easily hackable that everybody expects their computer is hacked seems to me to be insane, I guess would be maybe the word I would use.
Oh yeah, clearly. I mean, it's, you know, it's very obviously a case of someone who is, in this case, a judge who is allowing his personal feelings and his lack of experience to influence the judicial decisions he's delivering and affect his jurisprudence, rather than actually relying on, you know, facts and the way the world works. The fact that he's banging out this emotional appeal about terrorists can no longer rely on Apple to protect their electronically stored private data, I mean, pretty much automatically says that he's not attempting to do a reasoned, you know, properly weighted analysis of what's going on in this case in front of him. He's, you know, going from his gut, automatically assuming that law enforcement is in the right and that people who have something to hide automatically have something bad to hide. I agree with the EFF attorney. This will eventually be, either there will be other case law established to overwrite the decision, or it'll be overturned on appeal, one or the other. But I mean, it's, you know, it's just,
yeah, it's like, I can understand the NSA hacking people's computers for some sort of gain. I'm not shocked and surprised by, but I am surprised by, say, the FBI. The reason the FBI had to hack, as a matter of fact, is because this, and I guess just, I think it would be obvious to everybody, but I will just say it so that it stays obvious, is obviously the site in this case is odious and horrible. And I understand why law enforcement felt they maybe needed to push the boundaries to get access to the people who were, you know, fueling it. But a site that's running on Tor, those people, frankly, if you're doing your stuff through Tor, I think you have a higher expectation that you have privacy, not lower.
Well, you do,
yes,
but...
Yes, I know, but at that point, if I'm on Tor, I'm assuming that I'm... Here's the thing. If you download Tor, you're on a list. If you fire up Tor, you're on a list. If you do anything with Tor, people will be watching you to see what you're doing with Tor.
And,
now, they may not be able to tell what you're doing, but they'll be able to tell that you're on there.
Well, I was going
to
say, and unless you know how Tor works and you're up on your Tor game, you're not going to be anonymous with what you're doing. You're going to be leaking data all over the
place.
There
are some great talks about, like, you know, like greatest Tor fails on how people... You know, like the MIT bomber that... he wasn't an actual bomber, but the MIT guy that called in a bomb hoax to get out of taking his exam. You know, he was on Tor, but it's like, you know, they looked at all the traffic, and while everyone else was, you know, in exams, you know, in classrooms taking exams, he was the only one in his dorms logged into Tor. So it's like, you know, time-based correlation attack, you know, not that hard to do. So stuff like that. So people mess it up. So unless you're running, you know, something super secure like Tails, and you've got firewalls locking down everything else, and you make sure that not even a single UDP packet accidentally escapes over a non-Tor network, it's really hard to do. And even then, people control, like, you know, not to be all Mr. Robot, you know, whoever controls the exit nodes kind of controls the traffic. And, you know, there are a lot of exit nodes that we can't tell what's going on. And then the FBI's had this hack for a long time, to the point where Tor's like, hey, we're just going to have to, like, build something else. And same with Firefox, because they won't disclose what it is that's letting them get in. Yeah. So they're going to have to go and rethink Tor and rethink Firefox. So
yeah, the thing, though, that's very odd is... The judge, though, isn't talking about the technology of it. He's talking about what is your expectation, because I think that's where it comes. I think that's where this, what this swings on.
I mean, there's not really much. Maybe you do. Maybe there is a lot to talk about here. But I mean, in my opinion, there's really not much to discuss here, because the judge is simply making a massive error. No, he's simply wrong.
Well, hopefully someone else will come in and do it. But the whole expectation of privacy, that's what defines what, you know, constitutes a search and seizure. It's like, in my house, I expect, and this used to, I would expect conversations I have to be private. But now that now that I've got a mic on my laptop, or I've got, you know, a camera in there, I've got an Amazon Echo or anything like that, suddenly, because I introduced that in, that no longer holds. See, what makes me upset is the government's going to say stuff like this, but then they're not going to go do away with the DMCA. If I go hack a server, I'm still probably going to, you know, get a knock on my door and be in trouble, where I can't be like, what, the FBI servers, you thought they would be, but you had an expectation of privacy? Of course,
well,
I'm going to be in there.
That's the thing that, to me, I mean, they've kind of, I don't know, almost like, it almost puts them in a catch-22, right? Because I understand the ruling that they want to say, well, we should be allowed to do this, and they have to have some justification for it legally, right? And they say, well, nobody has an expectation of privacy, so that's why it's legal. But at the same time, if they say that, then to me, that puts into a decision, which puts into legal
precedent.
Code precedence for hackers to say, well, look at that case. So therefore, what I did, there shouldn't be any expectation that I couldn't do what I did, so...
Yeah, is this a crime? They already knew that, you know, if you take your credit card out and you use it out in public, you don't have any expectation of privacy. So when I take your PIN and I get the publicly available data off the mag strip, how is that a crime?
I think the differentiator here is that with is that these standards are applied to expectations of privacy from searches and seizures. So in the example the judge gave about how, you know, somebody can still like look in your house through your window or whatever, it's still illegal to like break the window and get in, even though, you know, I can kind of peek into the window maybe and like see stuff. So, I mean, similarly, it's still illegal for you to hack into somebody's computer.
But if the FBI installed malware on a computer.
They did break the window. They inserted something. But they're the FBI.
It's different.
But that wasn't stated in the decision, I don't think. But
clearly, because the judge is talking about how, you know, Apple can't, you know, help the terrorists anymore, the implication is that, you know, the good guys can do this and the bad guys can't. You know, the good guys can break into your house and, you know, steal your stuff and install keyloggers and malware on your computer, because obviously if the FBI
the
is
good
doing
guys.
It, you're bad and you're trying to hide something anyway. I mean, what are you not getting about all this?
If we are living in a universe of maximum irony, then Anonymous will read this article and release whatever kind of embarrassing information they can discern about Judge Henry Coke Morgan Jr. because of whatever his online activities are.
Starting with that his password is the name of his cat. And,
well,
and
or
he
that he's
that
got
password
an
for
account
everything.
On Ashley Madison, and the reason he doesn't feel like there's anybody has any privacy because all the sites that he had his stuff on got hacked and the info's out there. I don't know. It would be funny if he got doxxed, I guess would be the...
Well, I mean...
I'm not suggesting anybody should do it, but I think it would... I think when you play that game where you talk about, well, nobody has any privacy on the internet, if somebody shows what it feels like to really not have privacy on the internet, I wonder if his opinion might change.
Yeah.
I just can't believe that, you know, the expectation of privacy... You know, there's a reason that, frankly, there's all this control that's been being given out to the users so that you know, frankly, just the like blocking cookies, you know, the whole, what is it, private incognito browsing or whatever. That gives you the expectation. If you enable that, that gives you the expectation that the site you're visiting is not going to be able to, you know, track you to the kind of depths that they can under normal conditions.
Well, but still, here's the quote. I'm going back to the GigaOM article. Here's the quote from Judge Idiot, whatever his name is. Here he says, quote, "Just as the area into which the officer and Carter peered, an apartment, is usually afforded Fourth Amendment protection, a computer afforded Fourth Amendment protection in other circumstances is not protected from government actors who take advantage of an easily broken system to peer into a user's computer. People who traverse the internet ordinarily understand the risk associated with doing so." So I mean, he's specifically talking about LEO actors.
So here's where that makes it interesting. Everybody knows that the Fifth Ward is considered a somewhat dangerous place to go into. So anybody that goes into the Fifth Ward should expect that they might be patted down or taken advantage of or beaten up or whatever. And therefore, the police in the Fifth Ward have the ability to do this because everybody should expect that that might happen to them while they're there.
I'm not going home through the Fifth Ward tonight.
Because they have no expectation it wouldn't happen.
Yeah, and their federal, you know, or local, you know, officers or enforcement or whatever, they're representatives of the government, so they should be able to do this because everybody expects that might happen. And since they're the good guys, they should be able to do it.
Yeah, I think somebody's read way too many headlines, you know, that it's an easily broken system to peer into a user's computer. There's sort of arguments both ways. Obviously, out on a percentage basis, there's a lot of computers out there that you could probably get information from remotely.
No, he sounds like the kind of person who would be in the target demographic for CSI Cyber, honestly.
I mean, when it's so easy to zoom and enhance.
You know, I can defeat that dragon and get past the firewall with the best of them.
I know all about firewalls. I know no matter how many firewalls you have, eventually the hacker's going to get through them, so privacy's over.
Because I use my ice powers online. Shh.
I'm getting to, we need to talk about something else. So, it's just depressing me, man.
This guy, I don't know, for people of a certain age, he seems like he would be one of the characters on MASH who would come through for an episode or two. Or if you're real familiar with MASH, the guy from Intelligence who would come through occasionally on episodes. But yeah, the out-of-touch officers and that. Fortunately, our courts have multiple layers, but this guy is a senior U.S. district judge, so it's not like he's some kind of low-level dude. But I don't. I think everybody here probably agrees that this is not. This is unlikely to last past appeal. Now, the part I wonder about is then, has the FBI blown it where they found these people who were going to a child exploitation site, and have they blown it by, you know, violating the Fourth Amendment to get at these people? So are the people that they caught going to get away because or be free? I don't say that as a reason to you know, bend the law or any of that, because the, you know, for the children is the first thing that any demagogue uses if they're wanting to like loosen privacy controls. But you know, the FBI, then there's a real question if they cross the line and then that results in criminals getting away with it. That's pretty disgusting, frankly. But so moving on to some other stories, and I guess these are more substantive, so I figure we can talk about them after each one. There's an article from Fast Company that says more people work from home now than ever before, although that's not like a happy, good thing. That's not people who, I don't know, maybe like Lee or myself who work from home, where our job is mainly generating our labor at home. But no, it's more about the number of people who are spending more time working, because when they're at home, whether they work there regularly or work in an office somewhere else, they are doing work when they're there. That basically work-life balance is sliding downward because hours are going up, and that's because people are working at home with their smartphones and their computers that they have at home. They say, on the days people worked, 82 in their survey, in the 2015 study, they found overall employed persons worked an average of 7.6 hours on the day they worked. They put in more hours on weekdays as compared to, which was 8 hours, as compared to 5.6 hours on weekends. And then when it gets interesting is on the days they worked, 82% did some or all of their work at their workplace, while 24% did some or all of their work at home. 38% of workers in management, business, and financial operations occupations, and 35% of professionals and related occupations did some or all of their work from home. This is up 20%, almost 20% from 2003. It was 19% in 2003, and it's up to 24%, so almost 1 in 4 in 2015. Concurrent with the findings of longer hours, it reveals that the average time employed person spent working at home on days they worked increased by 40 minutes from 2.6 hours to 3.2 hours. It's also basically it flipped on what you would expect, which is that people with higher degrees of education and that are more likely to work from home or more likely to work from home, including if they work at the workplace and then go home. 94% of those with a high school diploma said they did their work at their employer's facility, but the 7% who worked from home logged nearly 4 hours at their residence. One of the counterintuitive findings was the amount of hours logged by those with one job as compared to those who held several jobs. Single job holders reported spending 3.28 hours working from home on their average day, while people with multiple jobs spent 2.88 hours, which is sort of just weird. Let's see, healthcare, technology, education, and education are the most well-represented industries for working at home. There are also openings in finance, hospitality, and research. Among them, more senior-level positions such as project management director, chief procurement and property officer, chief digital officer, and some of that were, the top. And then the other thing they say is that the flex jobs, which is one that hires for remote work or does more has more opportunities for remote work, indicates that Dell and United Health Group, Xerox, SAP, and Salesforce were among the top 25 employers with the most available remote jobs. So I don't know, it's one of those where if you work at home and you work more, is it? If you can't get away, is it better for you or not? And I guess I'll jump to the final story, and then we can, if there's something to talk about with it, we will. There's a GigaOm Change conference, which is going to be in September in Austin. And one of the interesting things with it, it's aimed at, here's what it says. GigaOm Change, artificial intelligence, virtual reality, nanotechnology, cybersecurity, 3D printing, human-machine interfaces, and robotics. So basically, like, all the stuff that's always just been a few years away, except now actually seems to not be that far away. The article's called Will the Robots Take All of the Jobs?
Yes.
And yes, they will. This article is more of asking the questions than giving the answers. One thing that they say in it that I think is interesting, they said the questions is fundamentally unknowable because it hinges on three independent factors, each of which is also unknowable. And what the author says is the three factors are how many jobs will the robot's AI really take? How quickly will that happen? And third, what new jobs will be created along the way? I think the problem with robots is as they do more things, that's not going to lead to a bunch of extra jobs for robot repairmen, because I have a feeling that a lot of this stuff is going to be multiple layers, that we're not going to hire humans to build the robots, just like we don't, the robots on the assembly lines are not hand built. They're built in a factory with an assembly line that has robots on it too. They point out some interesting articles around, one Oxford study claims that 47% of U.S. jobs could vanish in 20 years. McKinsey and Company has a study that says 45% of all work activities could be automated right now. So you can be scared if you think that's true or if it should happen. The author says two interesting questions that need to be addressed when approaching these issues are, one, why are there still good paying jobs in the West? Why hasn't mechanization put everyone out of work? And two, a century ago, Keynes predicted that in the future, due to labor saving devices, we will only work 15 hours. Why hasn't this happened? That one's probably right up there with the Fermi paradox to me. The widespread fear of substantial permanent joblessness has caused the topic of a universal basic income to move to the mainstream. And they're going to talk about, that at their conference. And then the money piece of this, I think, is he says, finally, it may simply be that in a post-scarcity world, quote, working for a living, unquote, just doesn't have the moral imperative that it used to. We might regard what Buckminster Fuller had to say on the topic, and here's the quote from Buckminster Fuller. We should do away with this absolutely specious notion that everybody has to earn a living. It is a fact today that 1 in 10,000 of us can make a technological breakthrough capable of supporting all the rest. The youth of today are absolutely right in recognizing this nonsense of earning a living. We keep inventing jobs because of this false idea that everybody has to be employed at some kind of drudgery, because, according to Malthusian Darwinian theory, he must justify his right to exist. So we have inspectors of inspectors and people making instruments for inspectors to inspect inspectors. The true business of people should be to go back to school and think about whatever it was they were thinking about before somebody came along and told them they had to earn a living. So Buckminster Fuller just justified the attitude of a huge chunk of millennials in this robotics article. And that is the news.
Boop, boop.
So, thanks, you know, for that, you wonder, is the thing, you know, I with the robot, you know, the automation and, you know, the change in that you have to have a job and idea that you have to have a job, is the thing where millennials, you know, the whole millennials are lazy and don't want to work and blah, blah, blah. Is that just the common, you know, generations where every generation thinks the one after them is shiftless and lazy and doesn't know the value of hard work like they do? Or are the millennials maybe do they have a little more insight into how much the world has changed and how it may be moving to something where you don't have to be, where the typical rules are not applying as much as they used to?
I think the typical rules don't have to apply as long as the parents continue to feed and house them.
There is a quote.
So there's that.
There is a quote from Socrates that, oh wait, hold on. I'm finding the wrong one here. Yeah, here we go. There is a quote from Socrates about how kids are like never doing the right thing and they're always screwing up, and because apparently this problem about the next generation being the laziest generation has been happening for millennia. And the quote from Socrates says, "The children now love luxury. They have bad manners, contempt for authority. They show disrespect for elders and love chatter in place of exercise." So even in the time of Aristotle and Socrates and Plato, etc., etc., apparently the younger generation was screwing it up then, just as they are screwing it up
what
now.
What happened to that society?
Exactly.
As well.
Well, but if the trend continued from there, then it's sort of amazing that that kids of today have the energy to lean over and pick up the remote, you know?
Well, that's because some you know, like disaster has to happen to reinvigorate people to have, you know, high work ethics.
The Visigoths.
And somebody has to come in and destroy culture or whatever to like kind of reset it so that the people that come out of that are the industrious people who then can have children who are continually lazier and lazier until the society's destroyed again.
What's that, Flicted? We sounds should like destroy all society?
It sounds like fun. It's either the plot for Mr. Robot or else it sounds like a version of the inherited wealth thing, where the reason we don't have to worry about inherited wealth is that usually within three generations comes the generation that'll just, you know, basically piss it all away. A family makes a lot of money. And the first generation, you know, worked like crazy and sacrificed to do it. And the second generation saw what the first generation went through to make this country great or company great. And then they, you know, so they work hard too because
they maybe had to work
down
in the mailroom of the first guy's of their dad's company to like also get up there.
Yeah, and so, but then by the third generation, you have, you know, the sort of the Paris Hilton thing where they're famous for being famous and they don't really produce any new stuff.
That's just the generation I want to be in.
They produce snaps and tweets, and you know, they're prolific.
I want to be in. That
they generate
generation.
Wealth.
Yes.
Is that what work of the future will be? Oh my! I keep having to fill my Instagram feed.
I think you know,
take another selfie today.
I think it's kind of moving there. I mean, basically, and this is going to be a division based on gender to some degree. I think, you know, most guys are going to where they're going to have Twitch accounts, and most women are going to where they're going to like get free makeup to sell it, you know, on the down low, like to pitch it on Instagram.
So we're all going to sell each
or
other.
Or if they have children,
YouTube
then to be
demonstrate
mommy bloggers.
Video games to each other. That's the future.
The future is mommy bloggers, makeup salespeople, which are either going to be women or like cross-dressers or transgender, like drag queens, drag queens, very popular with selling makeup. In fact, several of them now have their own makeup lines.
I know about that. Yeah,
Jeffree Star.
Jeffree Star. Yeah, yeah. That's
right. and then you know guys being gamers and doing Twitch. Not that there's no crossover, but that's the big areas I see.
You know Jeffree Star? That's crazy.
Although it's sort of. How many people, you know, the problem is it's still, the Twitch thing is still sort of a mass media model because it's one broadcaster with, you know, their 10 to 25 followers watching them play on Twitch. Oddly enough, it was a YouTube of a Twitch thing of a particular game, a speed run of a game called The Last of Us, which is not a fast game. A lot of cutscenes, a lot of stuff you have to do. And so apparently the like high speed on the hardest setting run is like 3 hours and 20 minutes or something. But the funny part, and I didn't watch the whole, obviously I'm not going to watch the whole 3 hours and 20 minutes. I skipped around, but
that's okay. Everybody does that.
It turned out to be a world record when he did it. It's been surpassed, but when the guy made the thing, it was a world record. And everybody commenting how there were only 100 people watching the stream. and then they were pointing out that, well, some of these people who have a lot more followers only have like 10 or 20 at a time watching them while they're streaming. So I don't know. The problem is it's like the people who are famous on YouTube are, you know, the big thing is because they have, you know, 5 or 6 million followers. And unless everybody follows everybody else, or like most people where everybody follows a lot of people, then there's a bunch of people who aren't going to make a living. What's the equivalent of a Walmart greeter in a YouTube society, I guess would be my question.
The guy introducing you on your YouTube video. Hey everybody!
Reaction videos. This is a huge industry.
Oh, I see. That's how.
This
that's
is
how
untapped
we get
market. Infinite, we can monetize this.
That's how we get the infinite recursion. Except it all would be, oh well, no, you pay us so that we'll let you do a reaction video and we'll publicize it.
Licensing.
You know, I do. You know, I mean that is my kids have a very different. Their thing is they watch, you know, they have their YouTube stars that they follow. And I must say for watching somebody play video games, some of those people are insanely entertaining to watch.
Like
that's
PewDiePie?
Not a long list. I'm not a PewDiePie.
No, not like PewDiePie.
There's a guy named Jack Septiceye who's Irish, who is, he has, you know, I don't think it's just the accent. He really knows. He talks to the camera. He's by himself. I mean, he basically is alone in
gamer.
His rental. And it's him and his camera and his video setup. But he it's very personable. He plays the game and talks. And it's entertaining to watch.
Yeah, we watch, me and Laura, my wife Laura, we watch a couple of YouTubers occasionally when we're killing time. Like, we watch, our favorite is a guy named Robaz. He also plays games on camera. He's Swedish. He swears a lot, though, so, you know, careful around the kids with that one. But super funny!
Fortunately, my kids are old enough that they can, you know, there's not really any limits on that one. There's a guy named Markiplier who's a big deal. He's real up and comer. He has like 6 million followers. There's another guy named Vinny who does not, he plays the game and talks, but he does not show his face on the videos.
Mm. I watched Unemployed Skeletor. and FPS Russia.
I work from home
FPS
now.
I'm
Skeletor and I work from the home now.
Oh man. But the thing is, his was, I don't think YouTube was around when he did his. I don't
what,
remember
FPS Russia?
No,
Skeletor.
Unemployed Skeletor. That guy was pretty funny. Sometimes it was hit or miss, but some of his stuff was pretty funny.
Yeah.
And it was funny. The thing is, I think some of his videos are now on YouTube, but I don't even remember where I originally watched it, but I'm pretty sure it was before YouTube existed.
Yeah, probably E-Bombs World or something.
Yeah, there were a few aggregator sites, too, that had, like, Flash animations that had videos and had stuff
New
like
grounds.
That where you could go kind of watch some
but
of that
But it
stuff.
Was... His was stuff was pretty funny, some of it is kind of dumb, but especially the first two or three episodes, pretty hilarious.
Yeah, what was the other one you said? Oh, FPS Russia.
FPS Russia is
pretty cool.
And I've watched
Ask
a few
Ninja
other ones.
Ninja was pre YouTube.
Yeah.
Yeah, I never really watched that. I remember it, but I never really watched it. I watched some of the. I don't remember who they are, but the guys that the slow mo guys.
Yeah,
get
I think
those
they're
cameras
called the slow mo
like,
guys.
6,000 yeah. frames per second, like those are. Pretty cool videos.
Those are neat. They did one recently that I saw where they were destroying cans of spray paint, like hitting them with axes and stuff, and it would explode. And it was great. It was great just to sort of sit back and be like, ooh, colors.
Why are we here doing a radio show right now? That sounds like
know.
So much more fun.
I've unfortunately also watched some videos, people, not because of my own choice, but because I was around younger people.
Yes.
And, Those I didn't enjoy as much. No, it's like people that are YouTube famous that have since gone on national tours doing their humor from on stage.
There's a con.
Is it the
like
English guys? Dan is on fire. Phil and Dan or whatever.
No, it's just like the YouTube. There was a big YouTube con called VidCon relatively recently. I think
I saw that.
The past couple of months, and like it seemed like from. Reading posts about it on Reddit and like watching some of the videos that got posted, it seems like my definition of hell. Like just like thousands of preteens running around periscoping themselves. It's just like one gigantic con about by YouTube for YouTube.
All the
YouTube
annoying personalities trying to out annoy each other on stage.
Stage. Basically, everybody with a shtick who is famous
or a selfie stick
was there. And then everybody who wanted to be famous and become a famous YouTube personality was there. And I mean, the people that do this, you know, I don't want to downplay the fact that like the people who are making huge amounts, and some of these YouTube guys, I mean, PewDiePie is a real outsider, like from an earnings potential standpoint. But I mean, these guys are making, you know, six figure numbers if they have millions of subscribers. This is, you know, this is a full-time job with real full-time job income. It takes some amount of talent. It's not just like point a camera at yourself and go. But people at this con were all like, you know, everybody was trying to be talent.
PewDiePie is making more money from merchandising than YouTube views, and he's still making like 15 mil a year off YouTube views.
Oh yeah, dude's rolling. He's absolutely set. All he's got to do is invest wisely, and then you know when he becomes old and unfunny, he won't have to worry about it.
I mean, the people I'm talking about, they're teenagers. They're attractive. Upper middle class or upper class teenagers.
Yeah.
Lonely Girl 15.
Who?
Or what was that?
Early, yeah.
Is she back? Is she really?
She's doing like a retrospective series right now. I thought.
But I mean, show. they're basically doing comedy shtick, but it's kind of gross out comedy or stuff involving food, where they like do challenges to like
a
lot of those people doing that. And
again, it's
the most
a low
part,
barrier to entry.
I think it's like. Annoying and not funny most of the part, but every once in a while something they do in the video is humorous.
Well, everybody
to
wants
me.
To be Johnny Knoxville, right?
But so the one thing that I did think that was clever that I saw these guys do, and they probably ripped it off from somebody, was, but you know, like you know, you can't really drink a whole gallon of milk within
right.
an hour or
right.
whatever, you
or
know,
you'll vomit. As you'll, 1 million YouTube videos
sounds
show.
Like a challenge.
And so and well, and gross. So the way these guys made that bit more clever is they got like. Five or six of them to
right.
do it, and they added a lot of food color to each one of them. So they were like, the milk was like bright red, bright orange, bright yellow.
Right. So
bright
it would be
blue.
Obvious who was spewing when.
Yeah, and so gross. It was like, and then it was like, you know, rainbows.
No.
Yeah, I'm with Groove on this one.
And they added.
Next
I think
story.
At some point they wanted to make sure that it happened sooner.
No.
So they
no.
add, so they
no.
added habaneros to the milk.
Next story, Pete.
Well, it's not just that kind of stuff. It's like people jumping into cactuses, and then there's all the prank
well, that's,
videos.
That stuff's just
and,
stupid.
You know, it's just horrible. I mean, it's just dumb. And I mean, it takes – you can't just – except for a very few instances of lightning striking, you're not going to become massively famous by doing, you know, idiot stuff like that.
It sounds in certain ways, it sounds like the early days of television too. You know, where it's just people trying to figure out what to do.
Yeah. But it is a lot of derivative of Knoxville, except maybe not quite as violent most of the time,
and without the physically dangerous,
and more like geared towards teen humor.
Without the EMTs on standby, right off camera, in case. I mean, dude, I've seen like some of the very well done prank video channels are very well done, but then there's like the vast majority of them that are not well done, where it's just like somebody walks up to somebody else and punches them in the face just to see what happens.
And then there's that whole genre of the like make you have feels video. You know, they're like, oh, we're going to, like, do this person. You won't believe what happens. And then, like, you know, some homeless person, like, is nice to somebody else. And you know, they're like, oh, you're so awesome.
Yeah, well.
Yeah. Well, or else that, well, which is kind of, you know, the whole ability to go viral.
Which is very different than the viral one that was a few years ago, which was, like, the bum fight, where the guy, like, you know, like, said that he would give a bucket and a squeegee to whichever homeless man beat up the other one. Very different
what could
version
possibly
than the,
go wrong?
Than the feels videos that are popular now.
Well, so I guess that's progress. Because notice on Facebook there's that trend of the sad story, and the internet makes it all right. You know, there was a picture of the sad grandpa who like had invited his grandchildren over and made enough hamburgers for all of them, and then only one showed. And they took a picture of the guy looking kind of sad.
Yeah, but that one wasn't. That one turned out to like not be real or something.
Oh, there was
the internet
one,
lied, man.
There was a nice one where this mom, whose daughter was having a baby, texted a bunch of family members that they were going to the hospital and like whatever dilating, blah blah blah. And she got a wrong number in it, and the person replied and was like, I think you've got a wrong number. But they were already on it. So they're like, yeah, we'll show up. So they these two guys actually showed up to the hospital and brought a gift to this random
right.
person. So that was kind of cool.
Could have ended so much worse.
Oh, God, yeah. Kidnap the baby. No, that'll be the – no, then they'll take it and twist it around into the whole you know, the whole horror story, you know, that doesn't work anymore. They're calling from inside the house, you know. Nowadays they wouldn't know because it'd be all cell phones.
The packets are coming from inside the server.
It's on your local segment.
Local host.
Or the other one that's a biggie on Facebook is the kid who has a birthday party and nobody shows up.
Yeah, I've seen a few of those.
Those, I guess, actually, when you're talking about little kids, those, you know, it's nice when you see the story where the, like, you know, local fire department
all
or
the
somebody.
Cops show
you
know, up, or all the fire department shows up. Or,
shows up yeah. and, you know, does something for the kid, and so they get a happy day and forget about the.
Pro tip, set the house on fire, kids, if you want the entire fire department to show up for your birthday party.
Well, no. Hey! Well, see, so now what you have is the, like, really popular kids who want to be viral YouTube stars trying to figure out how to have a. What can my story be? How can I get it where. Nobody shows up for my party, but that I get the party I really wanted anyway. How do we take that picture,
Ooh,
mommy?
Remember all those popular things where people like tell the pizza companies to like draw something?
Oh yeah, that's how do you how would
those
you like
are
it
pretty cool. Any special instructions and be like draw a dragon on the box. There's some really cool artwork that those pizza people have, you know, latent art talents that aren't being utilized while they're sitting there at Domino's cranking out pizzas.
I would feel bad. It'd be like, special request for your pizza. Yes, while you're, you know, going to jump into traffic and drive through rush hour to bring me my pizza, I want you also to entertain me. Draw me a fancy picture of a whimsical dragon when you bring me my pizza that I might tip you.
That are you only hear about the ones where it happens that the person is like an art, you know, has artistic talent to do it. You know, nobody's going to put up their picture on Facebook where it's like the pizza gets delivered and they're like, what, did you drop this?
I've seen some pretty awesome ones where they couldn't draw very well.
It's like, sorry.
But there's another hilarious one. There's like a picture of a pizza and the person's like, The pizza guy dropped my pizza, but I opened the box and they took a picture of it. The pizza had like folded on itself and like gone into a corner and stuff. And they were like, but my pizza looks like the Millennium Falcon. And it did. The way it split and everything looked just like the Millennium Falcon. They're like, so I'm not even mad.
What if it was the Millennial Falcon?
On the YouTube video front, sort of tying back in with some of this other stuff, there's a channel, and I cannot remember the girl's name off the top of my head, but she makes – it's sort of the perfect geek channel. She makes crappy robots.
Oh, yeah. This has become very viral.
She's amazing. I was just watching
the
one
best
of her.
One, yeah, the best one
earlier.
Was she made a like chopping, you know, kitchen robot, and basically it's two flailing robot arms with sharp knives in them. Chop, you know, you put stuff sort of vaguely in front of the thing with, I don't know, push it with a stick because you don't want to put your hand anywhere in front. And the thing just wails on it.
She makes things like to pour milk into cereal, and the initial, you know, video, the robot's working. They're more like contraptions, you know.
This was her
no
new
formal
one.
Training.
Her new one was the Deal With It robot, where it puts the sunglasses down, and then she just. Nice.
Someone eventually will get hurt. She goes on and says, "I've got no formal training, engineering training. I just like to, you know, put things together." And
whatever, don't matter.
It's funny. It's like if we
robots!
Made robots, only less carnage.
Well, somebody's got to make a robot to take crappy jobs, I guess. To be the chef that gets fired on their first day, or
I'm pretty sure I'll be able to still be a robot panderer at some point. There'll be some positions left for humans.
World's worst robot chef.
Oh well, yeah. Imagine the cooking shows with those. You know, you are the worst robot chef.
Yay! Oh! Beep boop, disappointment. Well,
you will now be incinerated.
You are the weakest link.
Now we'll have our expert panel try out your dishes.
Dish contains insufficient nutrients.
Well, we haven't covered lots of news. If you want lots of news, you can go to geekradio.com and find the links. I guess throwing in a few. Well, I guess we only have a couple minutes left. On Try By or Fry, there were a couple that looked interesting that I thought I'd maybe throw out there. One that Jay should have with him on his trip through Newfoundland. He should be lugging around a smartphone printer for his pictures,
so he can print them and then mail them to us from
yes!
Newfoundland.
That's right. And so we don't have to wait that 5 or 10 seconds for him to show up on Facebook. Think about how many there is still that, you know, or does it disappear now where people just are used to getting it on their phone and
Snapchat, baby.
On their phone.
Yep.
It's all Snapchatty.
Where the being able to print one out. But if you
can
have
you
old
print
people
this email
in your
for
life,
me, please?
You probably want one of these so you can print out the picture and look, Grandma, here, you can have this.
Well, I hear music, sir.
It's that time.
I guess we're getting close. I guess next week,
all
Mr.
back to normal.
Lee will be back, huh?
Yep.
As normal as it gets.
As normal as
cool.
it gets.
Well, right we'll, you know, just in case for the audience, you know, the rest of us are all feeling kind of poorly, so really support Jay next week when he's the only one in the
Jay Lee solo show.
Our absence has nothing to do with Mr. Robot season 2 premiere. Just to be clear, Jay.
Anyways, yeah, I guess the show will be more normal, but it'll probably have a lot of discussion of Newfoundland, GPS, and icebergs. I think that would be the key.
All right, we are out of time.
But for now, we've run out of time, so you have been listening to Technology Bites. I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Link.
And he's Groovehouse.
Mark your calendar for Saturday, September 17th, when Grammy Award-winning recording artist Ryan Bingham comes to Revention Music Center in downtown Houston. Since his critically acclaimed debut album, Mescalito, Ryan Bingham's gritty songwriting skills have been praised by Rolling Stone, Esquire, and The Washington Post, and many more. In 2010, Ryan Bingham's song, The Weary Kind, from the Crazy Heart soundtrack, earned him a Grammy, an Oscar, a Golden Globe, and an Americana Artist of the Year award. His follow-up album, Junkie Star, produced by T-Bone Burnett, received rave reviews from critics and fans alike. Singer-songwriter Brian Fallon from Gaslight Anthem will open the show. Don't miss Ryan Bingham at Revention Music Center on September 17th. For tickets, visit LiveNation.com. Presented in part by KPFT Houston.
Electro Love Fest 2016, a KPFT fundraising event, is seeking sponsors to empower KPFT's fundraising efforts and events on September 23rd through 25th. We have generous packages for those who sponsor Electro Love Fest 2016, including tickets, preferred seating, signed posters, multiple on-air announcements as sponsors until the September event, and much more. Please call KPFT Development Director Robin Lewis for details at 713-526-4000, extension 315, or contact event organizer Hank Lamb to find out more about the event, the music, and the opportunity at 936-239-0040. Thanks for supporting KPFT in Houston. 90.1 FM, your community radio in Houston.